For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online degree in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really pleased that once again I can welcome to our program Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of The Cold War, After the Cold War, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country and outside our borders as well. And on a monthly visit, Professor Sear is kind enough to join us on the morning show to offer his thoughts and analysis of various current events and issues. He is a regular presence on WUWM as well, and we appreciate the time that he sets aside for WGTD's morning show each and every month. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're always very gracious, and it's always a pleasure to be here, and I learn a lot as well.
Well, glad to be
really
talking
to
you. It's great to have you here. Right off the bat, I think it might be interesting for us to hear any thoughts that you might have about this enormous COVID relief plan that has just been signed into law by President Biden, costing over $1 trillion, kind of a staggering amount of money to try to wrap our heads around. Wonder if you have any thoughts about the kind of difference that is hoped will be made by this and the kind of difference that you think, in fact, it might make in terms of us recovering from the profound economic and social setback of this COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, I think it reflects the fact, with 2020 hindsight, that very aggressive public policy has almost certainly staved off what would have been a serious economic decline, downturn, if not a real crash, at least in financial markets and also in tangible production as well. I actually thought that was going to happen last spring when things shut down very dramatically, especially given what I perceive to be extremely widespread fear and alarm in various walks of life, at least from my aging perspective. So not for the first time I was wrong, but I do believe very aggressive public policy has been crucial and very wise public policy. I keep in mind, I know $1 trillion is real money, as Everett Dirksen used to say, about a billion here and a billion there, the longtime very important and admirable to me Republican senator from Illinois. He was the guy with the great mellifluous resonant voice. We have a $20 trillion plus economy in terms of gross domestic product. It's just phenomenal. And the production side, since the Great Depression started to fade in the late 30s for us, the production side has been crucial, and that remains. We are just a phenomenally productive economy, whatever might be going on socially and politically in the good old USA.
I remember reading one writer who very much supported this bill or something like it, saying that when it comes to something like this, it actually needs to be, in order for it to really pay off in terms of making a difference in our recovery, it needs to be big enough. And that while someone might think it's prudent to not spend as much money, in fact, that might be, in effect, sort of wasted money, because you would have a cheaper bill that wouldn't end up accomplishing at nearly as much as a bill that, in a sense, is bolder and more expensive. I just wonder if you have any opinion about that. I mean, if you think it's a good idea for this bill
to be as big, as expensive as it is.
It is bold, and it's certainly big, as we've just been discussing. Until really the last quarter of a century, maybe the last 30 to 40 years, but until very recent times, there was considerable concern in conservative circles about deficit spending. And politicians on that side of the spectrum, like the average American, would draw direct analogies between household income and one's own personal spending and the federal government. A big change, I think, can be dated at least from the 1980s, and Ronald Reagan, elected as a very conservative Republican, though that's not the way he operated in office, Reagan really embraced deficit spending, and since that time, both parties have done so. In fact, there are lots of differences between the household budget and any sizable public sector budget, including very reliable tax income, which private citizens don't have, unless you've got solid interest income, but even then you're not taxing others. That's a function of more sophistication and much more prosperity than earlier generations dealt with. It's also a change in the dynamics of spending between public and private sectors, which I don't presume to understand. Important thing when looking at public sectors is ratios. The deficit may be large, but look at the deficit as a ratio of the total federal budget and total federal income. Likewise, the debt may be large, but look at the debt as a ratio of total gross product and total assets, for that matter, in the private as well as public sectors. That's the way business people look at the world if they're successful. And that's a better analogy, I think. Look at it in a more dynamic sense. I hope this is clear. That's a better way of grasping what's going on. John Maynard Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S, the great British economist and public servant and writer who really defined our British friends spearheaded the economic institutions that were established during World War II as part of the UN. And he also, in terms of fiscal policy, really made a case for deficit spending. Again, in the past, seen as very radical, generally. He made the case for the importance of deficit spending when times are bad. He also wrote very insightfully that it's very easy for politicians to spend. As important as deficit spending is keeping things in surplus when times are good and paying down debt. And that's always a test for politicians. So we'll see as things continue to improve, as I'm sure they will during the remainder of this year, if good old Joe Biden and associates in the Democratic Party, historically the party more comfortable with deficits, to put it politely, until recent times, if they're willing to exercise discipline. Bill Clinton did. Clinton, whatever his shortcomings in office, was a fiscal conservative, and as federal surpluses grew, he did something very unusual among politicians in this country or other countries. He actually restrained federal spending. So we'll see if the current administration, assuming things go well, is up to that.
Hmm. Well, speaking of discipline, you used the term disciplined to describe what at least thus far has been the Biden administration's approach to foreign policy in general, and in particular, foreign policy regarding the nation of China. And you have a really interesting column that explores a lot of different facets about this. And one of the things you mention in the column is kind of an interesting dichotomy in terms of how China has conducted its affairs and related to the world, in a sense, increasingly open economically, but politically remaining very closed. And particularly when it comes to matters of cracking down on dissidents, continuing to be very harsh in a way that the typical American does not find satisfactory, to say the very, very least. What kind of challenge does this pose to us when we shape our foreign policy with China and sort of decide how we should move ahead with China? The fact that there are these two contrasting facets to modern day China.
Well, I think it's a challenge for the ruling clique in Beijing. It's an opportunity for us. The great nightmare that plagues them and doesn't plague us at all or shouldn't is what happened to the Soviet Union. Mikhail Gorbachev with great flexibility compared to, I guess that's the best word, compared to his predecessors at the top of the Communist Party and the totalitarian regime in Moscow, tried, and I think showed considerable skill and sophistication, but ultimately failed. He tried to open the Soviet economy while maintaining a political grip, and it all fell apart. China does not have the challenge of East European satellites, where especially in Poland and then in East Germany, freedom really began to get rolling. And then the whole system became unraveled. That's what really, I'm sure, plagues the leadership in Beijing, and we'll see if they're able to succeed. So far, they've been able to. They're increasingly hardline, as you indicate, not only in the very public and very brutal crackdown on dissidents in Hong Kong, but also increasingly in threatening Taiwan, which they don't control directly, as well as very, very harsh restrictions on the domestic population, including persecution of the Uyghurs, which does not get much media attention. One of our fine IPE students, Brianna Parks, has been doing a lot of research. She's worked in China, and I believe Bria is going back after she graduates from Carthage this year. It's a very, very threatened system. They're the ones with the real challenge, because the world at large, including their own economy, as you indicate, is moving in one direction, and these communist tyrants are trying to hold fast to something that's increasingly out of date, totalitarian dictatorship.
One thing I learned from your column, among several things, is the role that Taiwan has played in China's economic, let's call it, resurgence. At one point, you say one of the things we need to do, that is the United States with its foreign policy, we must specifically reinforce the role of Taiwan. This island finances the economic revolution of China.
Yes. Well, investment capital has been flowing into China especially since people's socialism was declared in 1992 by the great leader Deng Xiaoping. But since the 70s, China has really been experiencing modernization and industrialization and all the service industries that go along with an industrial, essentially capitalist economy. Private capital is important. But my understanding is a huge portion of that foreign investment is actually from overseas Chinese. The Chinese diaspora, not just in Asia, some people compare it to historically the Jewish diaspora, mainly in the West and the Middle East, but also these are international population phenomena. They tend to do very well in what are for them initially foreign cultures. And Chinese overseas individuals, individual savers and investors, as well as companies, are a big part of the fuel for the tremendous economic boom now longstanding and long underway on the mainland. And a lot of that flows through Taiwan, which so far has very skillfully, since the communists took over the mainland in 1949, managed to survive. Mind you, part of the very, very determined and heavy-handed, ultimately, strategy of Beijing is not to invade Taiwan, but that's been off the table since the Korean War, but to buy enough assets, control enough companies in Taiwan that the that they'll be able to take control eventually that way. That would also be a great way to kill off the goose that keeps laying golden eggs for the mainland. But that's the situation. I think it's extremely important to pay attention to what's going on in business and finance related to Taiwan, along with the always alarming rhetoric from Beijing about Taiwan. Mm. It really galls them that this island has managed to remain independent, but ironically, it's crucial for their success. Mm. That is the Communist Party's success.
Right. Speaking of rhetoric, you talk about how the Trump administration, in dealing with China, in your words, the Trump administration rightly highlighted China's commercial espionage, one of the things to which we've, of course, objected to most intensely. But, however, the administration's confrontational public rhetoric did not accompany a disciplined, sustained strategic approach that coordinated policy over time. You're underscoring something that probably is also worth our understanding, that it is one thing to issue harsh statements of condemnation. It's another to shape meaningful policy that brings about maybe the shift that you want to see in another country and what they're doing. And that was not something that the Trump administration had as much skill at pulling off as it did with rhetoric. I think it's a good point.
Well, I'm not surprised you agree with criticism of the Trump administration, but government by tweet until the president was banned by, now former president, was banned by Twitter. It's not a good way of going about public policy. In terms of policy, the Biden administration has not made any great departures from the appropriately tough stance of the U.S. government vis-a-vis China, both in terms of targeting, as we have in Russia, working with allies, individuals, but also in terms of tit-for-tat retaliation for unfair trading practices and espionage. But in terms of the style, there's a great contrast between the way Trump conducted himself in office publicly and what strikes me as a very orderly, low-key approach toward China and Asia generally. The trip this past week by Secretary of State Blinken and the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, joined by Defense Secretary, former General Austin, on a trip that included meeting with counterpart officials from China and Alaska, as well as South Korea and Japan, I think is a good example of traditional low-key diplomacy and not looking at just one country, albeit a great major power, but at the region generally. To me, it's at least so far reassuring regarding Asia.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Art Seer, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clausen Center. And Professor Seer, speaking of that part of the world, at least roughly speaking, I want to also draw attention to your recent column about the military takeover in Myanmar, also known as Burma, or once known as Burma. And this is a really interesting column as well, in which you open with three quotes from three different sources of mainstream media. And I'm pretty sure you chose them specifically because they represent at least a bit of an array of perspective. But they all say pretty much the same thing in this instance. And they all say the same thing that with which you take exception. That is, in framing the military takeover in Myanmar in a way that you think does not really reflect the full reality or the kind of the historical context of what life has been like in that sad nation for quite some time. Tell us what you think the media is getting wrong with Myanmar, or what they're getting wrong in terms of how they are framing what just happened there.
Well, the headlines, I believe one of the sources was the Voice of America, which is the information and to some extent propaganda arm of the U.S. government. This is a major test for Biden. This is a challenge for the Biden administration and the president early in office. The point I tried to communicate was that, and thank you as always for reading my column and promoting my column. I'm always anxious to have more readers. Myanmar is not a vital interest of the United States. They have a history of military rule. Most unfortunate from our point of view, we should work with the UN and other nations to condemn abuses and lawbreaking that takes place there. But it is by no means in any way, shape, or form a major test for President Biden or the Biden administration or the U.S. government.
In the discussion that you have about this in your column, you draw attention to all kinds of positive signs for that region as a whole in terms of economic well-being. Sketch that for our listeners. What's going on in that part of the world about which we should feel good?
Well, as in China, which we've been discussing, and Taiwan and South Korea and Japan, also part of the diplomatic trip this past week, we have the success of free markets. We have the success of our approach to commerce. And I think it's unavoidable that that tends to undercut especially harsh dictatorial regimes. I believe I highlighted especially Vietnam, which now has a stock market, a stock exchange. Laos has a stock exchange, a very rather vaguely defined country historically that does not have many of the characteristics of a nation state. Former French Indochina, this very large colony, was divided up into, in 1954, North and South Vietnam after the victory of the revolution, communist revolutionaries in the North, Laos. The development in Vietnam in the past two decades, especially of growing private investment, growing economic growth, and growing development and prosperity for the average Vietnamese is striking. As with China, the ruling elite faces the challenge of having an increasingly prosperous economy and consumer economy. They've in effect adopted people's socialism as well. That model and that rationale while maintaining political control. So far they've been able to do it, and we'll see if that continues. I went to Hanoi on my own in 1994 when I worked in Chicago with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. We were developing a large program on Asia, East Asia, which succeeded in terms of fundraising as well as programming. So it was part of a swing that included, as I recall, Hong Kong and Seoul, Korea, as well as Taiwan. I went from Hong Kong to Hanoi. It was rather difficult back then. Clinton was just in the process of opening diplomatic relations. But I wanted to go there, but we paid attention to timing in terms of our own institutional growth. I've met with very senior people in the foreign ministry and in their trade ministry, which had nothing to do with me except that I was an American, and they were desperate to meet Americans. It was when they were first starting the opening up process. I think it was Business Week, I quoted polling business people who are involved with international investment generally. Vietnam has catapulted to a very high ranking compared to other countries in Asia and in the world as an attractive place to invest. To me, it's quite significant, and it should be for others as well. It's a remarkable change for that country. When Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld visited Vietnam as part of the international meeting, I think it was the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. There's several economic, anyway, the Vietnamese played the Star Spangled Banner. He was honored with a parade. They were showing the American flag. Again, relations are changing with the United States, all for the good, but they were doing this not because of any great love for Rumsfeld as an individual or really the United States, but it really showed just how important they take their economic future. And if you're going to be successful economically, at some point you have to deal with the Americans.
To finish out, I am so glad that in the third of your recent columns, you highlight a name that I suspect a lot of Americans don't know as well as they should, one diplomat by the name of George Kennan. And you're marking the 75th anniversary of something that evidently is known as the Long Telegram, in which he set out his philosophy on how the United States should be moving forward, a telegram sent from Moscow to Washington. Tell our listeners about this so-called long telegram and the wisdom it contained.
Yes, indeed. George Kennan is a very distinguished, now deceased, but he lived to be about 100 years old. He was from Milwaukee, although his family had close East Coast and Northeast Coast ties. He went to Princeton and was related to and in many ways personified the style as well as heritage of the old Northeastern upper class, which had so much to do with our foreign policy until Vietnam. So there are some local ties with Mr. Kennan. He was a very effective Foreign Service officer. He was quite heroic in opening the U.S., playing a crucial role in opening the U.S. embassy in Moscow after the Roosevelt administration finally recognized the Soviet Union. He was born in 1904. He went to Princeton. He had experience under his belt as a Foreign Service officer, even back then. He was in Germany when the war broke out. And again, he was quite heroic and by all accounts played a significant leadership role, although he was not in charge of the mission. By default, he wound up dealing with the Nazis in a very, very difficult and dangerous time, and was instrumental in keeping people calm, keeping people, including children, protected insofar as they could be, and getting everyone eventually back to the U.S. after Pearl Harbor, when the Germans declared war on us, and diplomats and others were stranded in Germany. To actually answer your question, he was in Moscow again. He worked with Avril Harriman, fascinating character in business and politics as well as government, who was our ambassador then. And in 1946, he sent as a telegram, not in the diplomatic pouch. I think it was about 8,000 words long. He wanted to make sure the Soviets read it, as well as the people in the State Department. A very long telegram laying out the case for containment, which is the title of what defined American foreign policy after the war. It's easy to forget now. We were really struggling. A lot of people hoped that we could continue to have an alliance with the Soviets, as with the British. It fell apart very quickly over Berlin after the end of World War II. He saw that coming. A lot of people, including high officials, were rather innocent or at least optimistic about the prospects for democracy in Eastern Europe after the war. President Roosevelt was not, contrary to folklore and Republican propaganda from that era. Kennan warned, it's a brutal and ruthless state. He really knew Russian history. He was a true scholar and an impressive intellectual. They are not going to do anything but protect themselves. They're too insecure. They're too anxious, especially after the war just ended. But even before that, too worried about the West to do anything but impose harsh control. Rather than appeasement, which had a strong constituency in Washington, again, not Roosevelt, certainly not Truman, but Henry Wallace, who'd been FDR's vice president until he was replaced by Truman, thank God, in 1944, and then Commerce Secretary under Truman, he actually was in close contact with Stalin and the Soviet Union, and to some extent was a mouthpiece for them. There was also a strong constituency for going to war, or at least liberating Eastern Europe. In 1946, when all of this was just starting to unfold, Kennan provided what became the foundation for U.S. foreign policy in dealing with the Soviet Union and communist powers more generally. Just be patient, just wait, resist their efforts to be aggressive, especially in military terms, as we did with the NATO alliance and then the Korean War. But just wait, be patient, which is hard for people to do, especially, I believe, us good old Americans, and the system will eventually collapse. He was a really far-sighted prophet in that sense. Other aspects of his career didn't work so well, but the 75th anniversary of the Long Telegram, which nobody pays attention to in terms of public recognition anymore, I think is a good time to remind ourselves of how much we owe him. There's a very good biography. It's long, but very readable by a historian now at Yale, John Lewis Gaddis, G-A-D-D-I-S, which is readily available on tape. It's readily available on Kindle, as well as a good old-fashioned book. I really urge people who are interested in the subject to read the book. Kennan's a fascinating individual, but it's really extraordinarily well-written, especially by one of us academics. Gaddis has a real writer's genius.
I want to ask you about kind of your closing point in this column, in which you call on diplomats of this current generation to refine and update the valuable insights of George Kennan. What are you saying there?
Well, by the end of the Cold War, I mean, ever since Kennan's Long Telegram, which then was published in Foreign Affairs a couple of years later, the same basic message, the importance of containment. Since he had government responsibilities at the time, he used the pseudonym X, Mr. X, but it soon became public knowledge that it was Kennan who'd written this. You perceptive people could tell it sounded very much like George Kennan, and it was his point of view. With the end of the Cold War, especially, but even today, whenever there's a new administration, especially younger people, increasingly women as well as men, in important policy positions, or those who want to be, will try to reproduce and have the same impact that Kennan did. And I don't think anyone has. What Kennan was arguing for was the value, as you and I were talking about at the beginning, the value of traditional diplomacy and a realistic view of the world. Avoid idealism and belligerence. Kennan did not fare so well when the Republicans came back in 1952. Eisenhower swept into the White House with a huge majority, along with his running mate Nixon. The Republicans also finally took back control of Congress briefly. John Foster Dulles became Eisenhower's Secretary of State, not an isolationist, but a very hardline nationalist, a man who'd spent his career on foreign affairs, as well as very successful corporate style law in New York. He wasn't an isolationist, but he very much became an advocate for liberating Eastern Europe. And there was a kind of belligerence to him that complicated life for our allies. I think he was very useful for Eisenhower, given the temper of the times, much as Nixon was in domestic policy, providing cover and a shield and a lightning rod. Dulles could be, for a polished lawyer in one sense, he could be very crude and arrogant and domineering, even by big time or small time lawyer standards. And he seemed to get some real pleasure from sidelining, snubbing, trying to isolate Kennan. And Eisenhower did a very interesting thing. The Republican platform had emphasized liberation of Eastern Europe. Eisenhower said very little that was specific, but he did organize several working groups, comprehensive in nature. And under the title of the Solarium Conference, they met in their plenary sessions were in a big sunroom in the White House. Eisenhower put Kennan in charge of one of the three working groups, and George Kennan was so smart, and the people Eisenhower picked were so effective that they dominated the proceedings. And as Gaddis describes in his book, in the final discussion, Dulles was there sitting in the front row, politely and quietly listening to George Kennan. That was Eisenhower in action. And in effect, containment was confirmed. It had been a huge partisan conflict in 52, in a very ugly time in American politics. I tell you, ugliness didn't just start with Trump. our current period. Eisenhower very deftly, in effect, confirmed what had been foreign policy, which we finally defined after great internal struggle in the Truman years, in a way that really was crucial in keeping the peace politically in this country, more or less, as well as stability in the 50s. That was the kind of the pinnacle of Kennan's career. He'd been ambassador to the Soviet Union in the closing months of the Truman administration. They fired him and declared him persona non grata. Kennedy brought him back very graciously as ambassador to Yugoslavia. Kennan didn't do well in terms of ambassadorial posts per se. Kennedy gave him great support throughout his administration, but in the case of Russia, the Soviet Union, very briefly, and then Yugoslavia during the early 60s, it was not an easy role for Kennan. But he was remarkably influential, and my point was the mostly young women and men who were ambitious and serious about public service, instead of trying to be the next George Kennan, what you should do is really study realist diplomacy and diplomatic history and look for the wisdom in what has been a very durable work that he produced. We don't need to rewrite it. It's there. A good gospel. You don't need to rewrite the Bible.
Well, I appreciate that insight and all the other insights that you've shared in this conversation. As always, such a pleasure to speak with you. Dr. Artsir Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. Great to have you back on The Morning Show. I look forward to seeing you in April and one of these days seeing you in person in our studios. Take care and thank you so much for today's program.
You and I hope. Okay, well, thank you as well.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive.
And with some irony, I want to say that I have approximately 10 minutes to talk with well-known writer Susie Welch about her intriguing new book called 10-10-10, 10 minutes, 10 months, 10 years, a life-transforming idea. I'm sure many of you know Susie Welch as the work-life columnist for O Magazine. That's Oprah Winfrey's magazine. And she is also an executive in residence at Babson College Centers for Women's Leadership. She is a mother, a wife, and responsible for a lot of intriguing ideas about how we can live better and more fulfilling lives. And the intriguing idea, which is at the heart of this new book, 10-10-10, is what we will talk about for the next few minutes. By the way, this book is a Scribner publication. And Susie Welch, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this interesting moment when you had your eyes opened, first of all, to something very frustrating in your life, and then what was sort of the embryo of an idea of how to make better sense of your life.
You know, don't we all have these moments where suddenly we realize our lives are living us instead of us living our lives? I mean, I had that happen to me 14 years ago when I went to give a speech to a bunch of insurance executives in Hawaii. I was the editor and editor of the Harvard Business Review at the time. I brought two of my four children with me in a bold attempt to crack the work-life balance code. As I'm delivering my keynote, my two children clad in hula skirts, because I had warehoused them in a hula dancing class, come bursting into the conference hall, and they run towards the front of the stage. And I thought to myself, my God, what have I done? Something has to give. I have to come up with a process to live proactively, deliberately, in a values-driven way, instead of falling prey to the two deadly sins of decision-making, which are guilt and gut. And I had to wrap my arms around my life and live it forward. And 10-10-10, making your decisions based on their consequences in 10 minutes, 10 months, and 10 years, very fortunately came to me that day.
So to clarify, what we're kind of talking about, your moment of revelation was you realized you were not doing a very good job of balancing the important things in your life? I mean, like
of anything. I wasn't doing a good job of anything. I was trying to make everyone happy, and of course that just doesn't work. And first of all, when you try to make everyone happy, everyone is happy but you. And I was not living by my values. I was sort of sprinkling myself among every different value, sort of hoping no one would notice that some things mattered more or less than others. And that happens to so many of us because the world we live in is so fast and so overwhelming. And we don't make the deliberate decisions we need to make a life of our own creation.
So your book is a way of doing a better job with the choices that we have to make. You call it a new approach to making choices, and you call it also a steady discipline. So tell us, first of all, about this idea of what I believe initially was just simply 10-10 that came to you that day.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I'm sitting out on the balcony after this disastrous experience with my kids bursting into my speech, my big grand speech, and I thought, okay, I can't do anything about the past, but if I just make my decisions thinking about the 10-minute impact and the 10-year impact, things are going to be better. But almost immediately I saw that I was missing something, and that was that there's a middle 10, or there's a middle time frame when the impact of our decisions are playing out in the foreseeable future, not the distant future, and that had to be considered. And so pretty quickly 10-10-10 came to be, and as I started to tell my friends and coworkers about it, it was that middle 10 that a lot of people were leaving out. So I'm glad that I had the idea to put it in.
So give us the nuts and bolts of how 10-10-10 works when somebody is confronted with a problem. I believe one of the first things you think needs to happen is that you need to sort things out sufficiently to really pose a cogent question.
Yeah, so often we're in a messy dilemma and we feel like there's 14 different sort of cascading questions. You know, will this make Aunt Mary mad? What does this mean for my boss's, performance review? We've got to define the question when we're facing a dilemma. Sometimes just deciding what we need to decide is critical and changing. So that's the first part of 10-10-10, and there's a lot of stuff in the book to help you come up with those defining questions. The second step is thinking about all the options, not just the obvious ones, not just the ones that seem the most expedient. Really put out there all the options, even the ones that seem far-fetched, even the ones that are being stated by people you don't particularly like, and then you consider systematically the upside and downside of their consequences in 10 minutes, 10 months, and 10 years. And the third step is the hardest part of it, and that is when you bring your values to bear, when you have done a values excavation about who you are, what you want to be, what matters to you, and in what order, and you compare those to the consequences of your actions, and at that point, your 10-10-10 solution will emerge.
So tell us about the first time that in real life, in reality, you applied this to yourself. Take us through the process.
I was back from Hawaii with my four kids at home, but I was working full time, and I had promised the kids that we were going to stay home. I was going to be home early that night. We're going to watch Malcolm in the Middle. It was a great sitcom. It was our favorite show. I was going to be home for it, come hell or high water. I see them at 6 o'clock. Well, 5:55, my boss walks up to me. She says, "Susie, we have a production crisis at the plant, and I need you to stay late." And I said, "How late?" And she said, "I think we might be watching Jay Leno together." And I had to make a decision about whether or not I was going to say to her, "Look, I just can't do it," or if I was going to stay. And in 10 minutes, I knew that the kids were going to go ballistic, or she was going to go ballistic. Somebody was going to be mad, and I couldn't make them both happy. In 10 months, I could easily make this up to my children, and that I was a pretty, there mother. I was often home. I could make it up to them even that week with my behaviors. But in 10 months, I was going to be coming up for a performance review at work, and being there was very important in my job. And in 10 years, with my children, this was not going to be the reason they were in therapy. They would be in therapy for reasons other than this night. But in 10 years, I was heading towards being a single mom at that point, and my career was going to be built on these kinds of decisions. Then I brought my values to bear. Work mattered to me. And I knew I could explain this decision to my kids using 10-10-10. I called home. I had the babysitter put me on the speakerphone, and I walked my kids through my thinking 10-10-10, and my values and why I was doing it. There was a silence, and the kids said, "Okay, Mom." And it was the first time I saw how well it worked. And I started using it right away for all sorts of decisions after that.
You talk about how there were and continue to be all kinds of positives involved with thinking about one's life in this way. One of them being that this has a tendency to get us thinking more forwardly than a lot of us otherwise would, especially if we are living a life where we're kind of overwhelmed by the challenges of the present moment, where thinking ahead a half an hour is not particularly easy unless we really stop and make a concerted effort to do that. But I know that you are anxious for us to understand that, that this is about a lot more than just that 10 years down the road thinking that is part of this equation.
This is really about a way of life. It's about living a life of your own making and of your own creating. And so, you know, I always say 10, 10, 10 is deceptively simple because you first hear the idea and you go, oh, yeah, I can do that. But then you have to do the psychic workout of actually coming clean with yourself and the people in your world about what really matters to you. And one of the things that really amazed me as I've gone on the road with 10, 10, 10 and given a lot of speeches about it, it's how few people are really aware of their values, of who they are and what they really believe in, and the rank order of their values, and even how many people don't talk about those values with the people who are affected by them. It's like the elephant in the room. It's turning to your kids and saying, guess what, I love my job, or turning to your spouse and saying, guess what, I do want to spend time with my family. A lot of value stuff, we, even though it's the most important stuff at work and at home and in parenting, we avoid talking about it because it can bubble up some conflicts. But you have to if you want to live a life that's deliberate and filled with the kind of joy of living by your values.
I think one thing that will be of significant surprise to a lot of readers is that you devote an entire chapter to the science behind some of this. And I mean, in careful science, and some of it dating back a couple of hundred years, to help us understand why we tend to make the decisions we do, or the reasons we make decisions in the way we do, from sort of a scientific perspective. Just talk for a moment about why that's important to understand
and
all this.
When I started to write this book, I thought to myself, I cannot write a book about decision making if I don't get my arms around how we typically make decisions. Why does 10, 10, 10 work so well? I wanted to know, and to understand that, I had to look into the neuroscience of how we typically make decisions, and I discovered that 10, 10, 10 is a great intervention to how we are almost hardwired to make decisions, which is on gut, on speed, on pressure, and under stress, we make even worse decisions, because good decision makers, the neuroscience would show us, are made, not born. And so every kind of instinct that we have can and will lead us to making decisions that don't always lead to the most productive solution. And so if you get into the science of how we're hardwired, for instance, we are hardwired to take the information that we hear the most often and hold it as the truth, rather than the information that actually might have the most veracity. And we are hardwired to take information from people we like over information from people we don't like. Well, sometimes people we don't like are telling us the hard stuff we need to hear. And the process of 10, 10, 10 washes those impulses out just by the way it works. And so it does contradict our natural tendencies to make bad decisions.
So tell us about how exciting it's been to hear from various listeners who have heard about 10, 10, 10 and used it and made exciting choices in their lives. I suspect from the way you write about it in the book that this has exceeded your expectations.
You know, I started using 10, 10, 10 just for myself to get through day to day. I was a young, single, working mother, and I just started deploying it for myself. Then I started talking to my friends about it because it was working so well, and pretty soon it started to spread. But it was only after I wrote about it for Oprah that I started to get this unbelievable sort of avalanche of positive feedback, with people writing me emails saying, you've changed my life, you've saved my life. And then I had a friend who said to me, have you Googled your idea? And I did, and I saw all these websites and communities that had grown up on the web of people who were using this idea and sharing it with each other. And it's going to just sound so corny, but I mean, it blows my mind. It is so gratifying to have people, especially now as I'm doing the book promotion tour, to have people come up to me and say, I can't tell you how you saved my life, or you saved my son's life, or you saved my marriage. I've heard that many times, and it's about as good as it gets.
Susie Welch, your book is 10, 10, 10, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has been fun.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Kravitz.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at the hapless New York Mets with Devin Gordon, the author of a book called So Many Ways to Lose. Support for The Morning Show
comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profits from UW Parkside in partnership with UW Extension.